This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi. This is Q, the podcast. Highlights from the November 9th edition of Q, the program. Okay, on your podcast today, Karim Rashid, the Canadian-raised, internationally celebrated designer, is known for his bold, beautiful household objects. He stops by Studio Q to talk about the world of design and look into its future, or at least 15 minutes into the future. And we look into the past with the music of Elliot Brood. That's a band from Windsor, Ontario, who turned heads with their second record, Ambassador, a couple of years ago. Their deep, dark country rock sound is rooted in various traditions, and they're my Friday Live guests. Is it Friday already? Woohoo. This is Q. Big show today. Lots of great guests. I've got some gentlemen with facial hair in the studio who I want to introduce. One of my favorite bands that's happening in Canada right now. Alt country just doesn't do it justice. Not descriptive enough. How about Mope Twang? Abattoir Blues? Death Country? Better. But really, it's not as depressing as it sounds. You'll soon hear for yourself because there's a suitcase, a banjo, a guitar, a trio of guys in Studio Q today. And the suitcase is particularly fitting because my Friday Live guests, the band known as Elliot Brood, have crisscrossed the country a number of times since the 2005 release of their second album, Ambassador. They're a little road-weary now, just got in from a gig in Regina. Mark Sasso, Carey?
KC.
Why does it says Carey here? And I was wondering if you'd been through a name change.
No, maybe soon. No, it's still right now.
Yeah, it's still KC. You're still
I'll
going KC.
KC
Laforet and Steve Pitkin are the troubadours behind Elliot Brood. Welcome to Studio Q, boys.
Thanks for having us.
Maybe you should go with Carey, you know, like
it's
the movie.
Bad.
It's not so bad. Yeah.
But after the IE ending?
Well, you get some news out of it, you know? Elliot Brood man changes name.
You're going to get a letter from my mom.
Let me just clear something up before. I'm really looking forward to you guys playing a song, and you're all set to go here. Steve, you look like you just want to play a song. You don't want to.
I'm ready to go.
You're ready to go. I see you got the sticks in your hand. But I introduce you, and I remember when we were doing the national playlist and talking, you guys, your song, The Bridge Was Storming to the Top for weeks on end. We talk about you being Windsor, Ontario's Elliot Brood. Now, Steve, when you and I were playing in the York County All-Star Jazz Band together.
That's not Windsor.
That was not Windsor.
That's right.
So what's the story behind the Windsor?
I wanted to say it then, I get to say it now. Newmarket represent. I went to Newmarket High School and Newmarket all the way. And Tokyo Police Club, you're not the only ones from Newmarket High School.
And Mark and Casey / Carey, you guys are you the Windsor contingent?
We are
indeed.
All right, so Windsor's represented, as is Newmarket.
Thank you, Gian. Finally.
Go. The new Windsor market.
Yes. But,
well, yes, Newmarket is considered the Windsor of the greater Toronto area. I don't know. What are you going to play for us? You're going to start with a song. Is this a new song, Mark?
It's not, actually. It's off our first EP called Tintype, and it's the very last song that was recorded for the album. And it's just a quiet number about the mines, I guess.
All right, yeah. Let's do it. Elliot Brood, live in Studio Q.
Timber. surrounds them, this well where they lay. And all that it shows is I'm riding in time. And all that it shows is I'm riding in time.
Live in Studio Q. That's Elliot Brood from the EP that they put out in 2004, Tintype. That's the song Riding in Time. Nicely done, lads.
Thank you.
bringing the Windsor and Newmarket sound to Studio Q. You know what's interesting about that song? Mark and Casey, you guys are playing the acoustic guitar and doing the vocals on that. You do something in that song that you do in a few Elliot Brood songs, which is you sing together, but you sing in unison. You choose to actually double your vocals rather than singing in harmony. And that's become something of your sound. Why do you choose to do that?
Casey? Lack of ability to harmonize, probably. Never tried. I don't know.
It's just kind of how we try. How we started out. We didn't even really think about it. You know what I mean? We're not classically trained or anything like that. Or trained in general.
So you've had very little training.
Yeah,
in general. Right?
It was just like when we were playing, we just kind of matched our vocals, and it kind of worked because it's like Casey has a voice really similar to mine, and it's kind of
really similar. Like you almost sound like siblings, which is what people really shoot for. I mean, that's ideal.
We may as well be by now. We spent enough time together.
Have you?
Did
you?
We're brothers.
Well, we just drove 33 hours from Regina.
And no one's dead yet
to play on cue.
did you drive from Regina?
Oh yeah. We had this show to do. We had to get home.
Wow, I didn't realize you were driving back from Regina.
Yeah, we've done it a couple times actually.
Many of us have done it many times. Yeah. but that's quite a. How did the trip go?
It sucked. Well, we were supposed to come straight because we've done the straight 31-hour one before, but we ran into some snow up around Ignis, I guess. Yeah, our favorite restaurant.
When was the gig?
Tuesday night.
Oh, I said you had 3 days.
Yeah, but we were supposed to come straight, so we could have a day off first, but
right.
it didn't work.
We wanted to be safe about it.
The snow stopped us. Mm-hmm.
Do you guys, and where did you stop? If, when you stop along the way, you're such a mobile band. Do you ever just try and, you're probably sick of playing, you know, like pick up the instruments in Thunder Bay or something? And no.
We have done some busking on our first tour, like outside of, in Edmonton, I think we did that.
Outside of Chapters.
To make some
to raise
lunch
some money.
Money
so we could eat. But that was about it.
Yeah. You're over that now. Tell me what, when I talk about you being a mobile band, I mean, you're starting to become famous for, Steve, you have the suitcase, which doubles as your bass drum. And sometimes you play drums on found objects. And you're all very, very sort of organic with your instrumentation, found objects that you use to play. Where did that idea come from, Steve?
The suitcase came because they were duo first, and I was their sound engineer, and I recorded the record. And actually, it started with a 2-gallon peanut butter jar they were hitting on the floor to try to get a big stomp, right? I don't know if you can hear this or not, but we're trying to pull a stomp sound out. And then when I joined the band and for their kind of CD release, I wanted to recreate that stomp without going overbearing with a drum kit, because this is just an acoustic act. And, you know, at the time we were all acoustic. And
when you say the stomp, so you wanted to sound not necessarily like a drum kit, but
kind of mimicking the sound of the record too, where there's just, you know, two guys playing with a stomp, and then I was just filling in a little bit on the snare.
And the suitcase was better than the peanut butter tub?
Well, easier to carry.
It's two hands for that.
Right. Yeah. But if you bring the peanut butter tub, you if you get hungry, you know, you have...
Yes,
you know.
But it doesn't hold as much gear. Like, the suitcase holds all the
stuff. You actually bring the stuff in the suitcase.
Yeah. We used to be able to tour 3 or 4 people and still see out the back of a minivan, which not too many bands could boast that.
Yeah. Tell me about the imaginary world around Elliott Brood. Do you guys seem to be fascinated with history and becoming characters, certainly on your first EP and then on Ambassador, which was accompanied by photos of you looking sort of like a 19th century infantryman or something. What's the fascination with history, Casey?
We both share that kind of a good story is kind of the first thing that interests us, I think, collectively. But there's just something about the past, about things that you can't get back now. Like, we're fans of like the antique shops and thrift shops, but there's just a fascination with things past. And like, Mark has a collection of old photos, and you just, when you're looking at stuff like that, you wonder where the stories are behind that kind of stuff. And it's just interesting to try to pull it out. Like with the Elliott Brood thing, the character that we've kind of developed, which we feel we kind of embody him, is just this character who shows up throughout time in different places, kind of, at least through the first two records so far.
But always in the past.
Well, yeah. There might be a futuristic dance Elliott Brood album coming out one day, too.
Actually,
but we don't know. Lasers.
I think he appears wherever. I don't think he's in the present. I don't think he's in the future necessarily. Right. I don't think he's like, you know.
But so far he seemed to have been in the past, the character, which makes it an interesting sort of superheroes clash on the show today, because Karen Rashid is coming up, a designer who's focused on the future, and you guys focus on the past. And it's going to be like, you know, not since the Legion of...
It's going to be a big scrap in here.
There's going to be a scrap, and I'll be in the present, in the middle. You're working on a new record, is that correct?
That's correct.
Do you have a sense of where that one's going to be set? Because I've heard something about the Second World War on this record.
It has to deal with that to a certain degree at the moment. We had about 5 days off on tour last year when we were in Europe, and we just, you know, we got to go to Juno Beach, and we got to actually see where a lot of things happened, and I think played on all of us as we were driving through and kind of taking it all in, and, you know, it just gets you to thinking about the people that, you know, gave their lives. And I mean, November 11th, that's actually, you know,
coming
2 days,
up, yeah.
It's coming up. So it's just, it's something that plays on your mind.
When you think about where the character Elliott Brood is going to be, or what, as you say, you've been thinking about focusing on, is that what informs the music then coming on the next record? Or do you take the music as the cue for where the character is going to go, Steve?
That's a good question. I think it's all circular, like, you know, it's bouncing off each, really. It's, you know, I don't think the Elliott Brood character is necessarily dictating what's happening. You'd probably have to ask Mark more lyrically, but...
Mark?
Casey?
Well, I know, like...
Carrie?
Carrie can answer. I'll handle this one. Carrie Laffred has the answer. Well, I know with Ambassador, it was kind of like, the songs kind of, they're not necessarily stuck in a certain time, but we kind of dictate where that period is. With Ambassador, the idea for the artwork and the whole package came after kind of the sequencing of a lot of the songs, and we got that idea kind of as it was being finished. So with this one, the same thing. There's no plan. It's just kind of thing like, let's see what this, where the songs kind of take our ideas, and then the artwork and the rest of it will probably reflect a certain time period. We love like that kind of, usually to have some sort of a theme or some kind of collective thing with the record, whether or not the songs go one after another in a narrative or anything like that. It's,
exactly.
It
it's
doesn't
like,
matter.
It's, we try not to let any one thing dictate everything too much. We kind of let, you know, you want something organic to happen. And you know what I mean? Like on the last album, we had this little tape recorder. It's called the Toby Quarter. And it kind of factors into one of the songs where it's just like this little kid talking to his dad around Christmas. And just like, there was supposed to be a whole bunch of lyrics. And we just actually chose to actually let that kind of play into the song as opposed to having our idea or my lyrics kind of, you know, we chose to meld it together as opposed to like forcing the lyrics to take over.
Speaking of something organic taking over, your audience has grown across Canada. And when you started, you were doing something, you still are doing something outlaw, if you will, in terms of the normal sound of what people bring to the stage and do in independent Canadian rock or something. You called it death country at one point. What has surprised you about the fan base that you have developed based on what you, the idiosyncrasies of what you do musically?
I'd have to say how wide it is, actually, like to the point of like, you know, we're just in Victoria the other day and this lady, I don't know how old she was, but you know what I mean? Maybe
mid-50s
to close to 60 or something like that, where they're coming out and they're listening to our music. And that happens in Europe as well, like where there's older people just as well as there's like young kids that are coming up to us and talking to us. So it's like it's such a huge spectrum, which we wouldn't, you know, not that you're out there to kind of design that, but I mean, who knows? Mm-hmm. I don't. Any thoughts?
Well, we've had everyone. Like the crowds have been different. Even that time in, I think it was Lethbridge, like, We were playing a show and there was a bunch of guys with like the studded punk jackets, Anarchy and all that. I thought they were there to beat us up, but they were totally there. They had heard about us and were there to see us. It was amazing. Right. And obviously they're the nicest guys. The ones who look the most threatening are usually the teddy bears.
They were there to get beaten up by the older lady in Victoria.
So. But we thought they were there to just, you know, oh, here comes trouble. They're not going to like this when they see a banjo, but they were all over it. They loved it. So it's, yeah, there's really no lines. It's, we've seen a bunch, you know, tons of different kinds.
Well, it's good to have you here. We're going to hear from more music from you. You're going to stick around, right, for the next hour. Yes, Elliot Brood here live in Studio Q.
This is Q, the podcast, with Gian Gameshi from CBC Radio 1.
We are back here live in Studio Q, and Karim Rashid has just walked in. So I've got to the right of me, Karim Rashid, to the left of me, Elliot Brood, to the right of me, the future, to the left of me, young men obsessed with the past. How do you like that? You see,
well, it's an eclectic world.
It is. Let me do your official introduction. Okay, listeners, look around you right now at the pan you're holding, the chair you're sitting on, the fork you're lifting up to your mouth. Do you know who designed those items? Maybe you don't. I don't. But we interact with about 600 such products a day. And for the most part, the design speaks louder than the designer. Unless you're Karim Rashid. From Dirt Devils to Prada Cosmetics, manhole covers to luxury hotels, the Egyptian-born, Canadian-raised, New York-based designer is a relentless innovator with a mission to change and beautify the world one design at a time. So I've got high hopes for our studio today. We can get some free tips.
This is not a bad studio compared to some of them I've been to in the world.
No, it's very nice, but it's a little, you know, you're the most colorful thing in it right now. So,
thank you. Are you flirting with me?
I may be. It's been done, I'm sure. Karim Rashid came to our attention in the mid-90s by glamorizing everyday plastic products through designs like the curvy O chair and the hugely popular Garbo garbage can for the Canadian housewares company Umbra. Major museums all over the world display his work. He's in demand by retailers from Home Depot to Issey Miyake. Despite these accomplishments, Karim Rashid is someone who looks resolutely forward, at least 15 minutes forward. That's the focus of his new exhibition of work opening tonight at the Ontario College of Art and Design in Toronto. It's called From 15 Minutes into the Future. International designer Karim Rashid joins me now. Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
You really are the most. Let me just describe. You're in a bright pink top. Nice white pants.
I usually only wear white and pink.
That's, I've heard
I
that.
I started that in the millennium at 2000, yeah.
Why did you start that?
Well, because it's a bit of a reaction to us all existing in kind of archetypes of uniforms. And most architects and designers are all wearing black, and the urbanites wearing black, and I decided to kind of go against it and just actually be self-expressive. And this is something, when I was a child, I was kind of obsessed with whites and pinks and color in general. So I thought, you know, I should find myself a little bit and be who I am and also inspire others. I think a lot of this world actually needs some sort of elevating of inspiring us all sensorially, constantly. And the digital age at this point, which I'm fascinated by, which I use in my process of my work and in other ways, is so experiential and so inspiring. And the physical world for me is kind of a bit banal and dull.
How far do you take the method acting, if you will, the pink and white? Is this when you're home alone in bed? Are you still only wearing pink and white?
Oh yeah, sure.
You're owning it.
It's not method acting. It's just me. That's who I am. In fact, I have white nails right now too. So, let's put all that aside for a second, because I think a lot of times look at those things as kind of superficial, and it's not really the issue. My issue is that I'm interested in. I'm educated as an industrial designer, and I realized that, you know, our entire built environment was at some time designed and built by others, and we all walk into this world as children, and we grow up in this world, and we behave. And experience what other people did for us. They tell us how to live. And I questioned these things greatly when I was a teenager and when I was younger than that. And I always thought that, you know, I would like to see a better world, a kind of more utopic world, a more beautiful world, a more poetic one, and a seamless one, meaning that we all can kind of live together in kind of perpetual beauty. And I mean beauty not on a superficial level either. I mean it more on an aesthetic level, a kind of experiential feeling that we all have just while we're here on this earth, that we have kind of better lives.
I want to get specifically to some of your ideas and, in fact, also to the confidence that you have, that you gave us a little insight into where it started, to comment on, to reflect on, to opine about the things that you see from Tim Hortons to the Toronto Maple Leafs to city designs, etc. We'll get to that.
Well, that was a kind of difficult challenge. I mean, I didn't want to be too critical about it.
Well, I want to ask you about that stuff. First, let me ask you this, though, because I want this exhibit, which is opening tonight, 15 Minutes into the Future, is a showcase of 2,000 objects designed
no,
by
it's,
you.
No, it's not.
It's
no,
not.
I don't know where that came from. It's about 100 objects designed.
Okay.
I have designed about 4,000 products and objects in the world. It's a small gallery, so we could only put about 100 in there. So,
well, the question remains the same. How does seeing all those things in one space, reflecting, even if it's on the near past, the recent past, reflecting on your past, feel for you?
Well, that's why the show's called 15 Minutes into the Future, actually, because I think that, you know, we all, as Warhol said, we all have 15 minutes, and I don't want to believe that I've had my 15 minutes, so I decided the 15 minutes is still coming.
But is there not a paradox or a contradiction in terms of an exhibit about the future that features designs of your past?
Yeah,
that's what I'm trying to get.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Well, you know what? You know, first of all, I just kind of go back very, very quickly. In the 50s and the 60s, we had a very utopic, visionary opus kind of to the way the world would become one day. Hmm. And the visionaries, whether they were Buxminster Fuller or Victor Papanek or Luigi Colani, many, many, many people, saw a world one day that would be very, very seamless. And I say seamless, I mean that in everyday life, we're not kind of bombarded with banalities. You know, it's a little bit like the Charlie Chaplin film of, you know, where a machine is brushing his teeth, et cetera, et cetera. Well, we're moving to that very, very, very quickly. So with that said, a lot of my ideas, a lot of the things I've done, and a lot of the companies I work with, my interest was always to design as contemporary as possible ideas that would end up manifested in the physical world. And contemporary means really not a style. It means about touching, engaging, kind of embracing the moment in which we live. So to study kind of social behavior, the materials, the technologies, the production methods, et cetera, et cetera, and our milieu kind of, and try to address it So really, even though the things, everything is kind of, you know, attached to the past and it's, you know, instantly becomes past as our conversation is, it's a present past, meaning a lot of the things that I've done in the last 15 years, and, you know, really I've only been practicing on my own for 15 years, is being this notion of really trying to make a contemporary world. In other words, because design can get very caught up with notions of style.
Yes, yes. And I want to quote you here as saying, to participate in a contemporary world, as you just said, you've said, to release people from themselves, from nostalgia, antiquated traditions, old rituals, kitsch, and the meaningless. I'm curious if you're a notable and often noted interest in the future means that you see nothing of value in the past.
No, first of all, my interest is of now, not the future.
Okay,
you know, and there's you know, artists, we don't really see the future; we see present as everybody else sees the past. When we're very perceptive of the present, that's what we work with, and that's what we address. And it's not a denial of the past; it's just saying that, you know what, we're alive and we live now. And I'll give you some examples of this. Is, you know, I remember about 7-8 years ago, I was an associate professor teaching at a school and in Philadelphia, and the classical school department was closing, and 200 faculty were very, very upset at this in a faculty meeting. And I thought about it, and I stood up and I said, you know, why are we upset? I mean, you know what? People are not interested in classical music anymore, young people. So, of course, the department eventually is going to close. But really, the reality is classical music is 300-400 years old. Now, strangely enough, ironically, they were building a 10-story multimedia building next door, and 6 stories of it were dedicated to electronic music. So, you know, what we lose, we gain. And it's like, I always think of it as kind of Newton's theory of mass. We lose a ritual, we gain a new ritual. We lose a tradition,
right.
We gain a new one.
But when you're designing and you're thinking of what you say is the present, the contemporary, that I'm just wondering where your mind is. You design the chair. Do you say in your mind, this is something that's going to work 20 years from now?
No.
For everyone? You don't even go through that thought process?
Not at all. No, I go through the process of what's going to happen to it if it becomes, does it end up in a landfill, or how is it recycled, etc. I worry about the sustainable issues, but I don't worry about whether we'll be using that chair 20 years from now.
Even in a business model, you don't.
Not in a business model either, not at all. Why? Because we don't live in that business model. I was working on a mobile phone, 2 years of work with engineers, etc. In Japan, it goes to market for 6 months. That's how long they sell mobile phones for. And the average shelf life of all high tech, like your laptop, is 11 months. We live in a disposable society, in a disposable world. We don't want to admit it, but it's a reality. We change our car on average now in America every 4 years.
Is that a lot?
We don't own cars anymore, right? Remember, you sit there and polish a car and care about it and nurture it and et cetera. We're living in a different time now. We're using goods and things and spaces and objects, et cetera, in a momentary way. Mm-hmm. And for that experience at that moment in time.
I'm glad you brought up the owning the cars, because one of the most provocative things you say that I'm really interested in is this idea that you believe we aren't going to own anything or be interested in owning anything in the future.
Right.
Which, first of all, tell me about that. Give me that thesis if you can, in a nutshell, so that I can respond to it.
Well, let me say, first of all, you know, because I'm a product designer, industrial designer, firstly, you know, I, of course, like objects, and I like the physical world, and I like physical goods. But I'm also very aware that we are having better and more heightened experiences in the immaterial world than we are in the material world. That's a fact. So in turn...
Yeah, and what does that mean?
Well, what I mean by it is, let's say, you know, last year for Christmas, the top 10 Christmas gifts in America, 6 of them were immaterial. You know, one was like gift certificates for spas and massages.
I see. Okay.
Another one was food and wine or beverages. The other one was video games, software, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so music. So this means that we're interested in experiences, but we don't necessarily have to have something physical to grant us that great experience. And in fact, when you get used to having heightened experiences without physical things, I'll give you a good example is the phone. You know, the minute we start to have a digital phone on us that's going to be basically our earring, you know, or it's in a little implant in the ear, mm-hmm. we won't even go back to that physical object. We couldn't care less about that physical object. We have the experience of real-time telecommunications.
But aren't we still putting at a premium in this in our society, owning possessions, owning things? And let me give you an example, a contemporary example, because you brought up music. The failure, the relative failure of subscriber-based music services, i.e. you pay a bit each month and you have sort of a library where you can borrow songs from, as opposed to something like iTunes, doesn't that suggest that people still want to own, you know, they still want to buy, even if it's for 99 cents, they want to download the songs and have them, own them, as opposed to borrowing, that there's something of value that people see in, even if it doesn't come in the crystal case anymore, owning this music.
Well, you know what, ownership, there's two ways of looking at ownership. Yeah, that could be maybe a new definition of ownership, but what are you owning? Binary notation, zeros and ones. You're not owning a record with an album cover, you know. It's funny you're saying that. I'm designing right now a music server for mass market. It's a 750 gig, and it's basically, you know, you pop your CDs in there, and it does it one-to-one, which is great because then the quality is there versus MP3, et cetera. Those kind of boxes, this kind of like this notion of taking so much information, so much memories, all these sorts of things, the data that we can record our lives, that we can experience our lives, and yet at the same time it can be reduced to tiny, tiny little kind of bits of data of information is fantastic in a way. Now let's say this frees us up from something, by the way. What it does is, and this goes back to kind of a lot of French philosophers like Jean Baudrillard, many of them, Paul Verlio, talked about this kind of notion of that the more we have in life, the more obstacles we have, which is true. So if you say, if you dematerialize, then maybe the material things you have in your life then can be the most beautiful, most engaging, most satisfying, most pleasurable things. And maybe some of those things you will own for life, and not everything will be completely disposable. So it'd be nice, you know, it's a little bit like a wedding ring or something. We put so much importance on this little, in a sense, small little object. We grant a lot of meaning on it. So maybe if I turn around and have to design things in the physical world, or I design things, I'll try to imbue them with as much meaning, as much beauty, as much personality, as much character, as much quality as possible.
Does it generalize for the big things? Houses, real estate? We're not going to want to own those things?
You know what? I think we will. I think, you know, the next part, and it's a big, big discussion, so we won't get too into it, but it's this notion of variation, is that we're going to start owning, when we talk about houses, everything will be personalizable, customizable, and individualized, just like a car. You know, if I buy a car right now, I went and bought a car recently, a few weeks ago, and I thought to myself how absurdly backward the whole industry is. I should be able to push a button, just like I do with my bubble jet printer, for 16 million colors, and have any color car I want. Number one, I should be able to have the seat, the driver's seat, designed for my body. Number two, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the world we're going to move into. So the home is not going to be anymore a cookie cutter of everyday mass development. Every home will be customized and done individually. And we're moving in that individual world. Like all my Levi's I wear are all customized. You can go tomorrow and do that on the internet. You can customize your own running shoes. You can customize your own shampoo. We're only beginning when it comes to that.
It's a great pleasure to have you here. I know you've not done a lot of interviews on the CBC. It's a
how do you know that?
Well, because I've been told that you, for 10 years you haven't done an interview.
You know,
on the
my
CBC,
father worked with CBC for 20 years.
I know. I think
so. That's
it more
this
often.
Is the least I could do, right?
Thank you for coming in. I've got so many questions to ask you. I hope hopefully it'll be to be continued. I hope you'll come back sometime.
Well, come to my lecture this afternoon.
I'll try.
Yeah. Gian, thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure meeting you. Thank you.
Karim Rashid.
Do I get to hear the band now?
Yes, you do, actually. Let me give you an extra U, and then we'll... Karim Rashid, his exhibit From 15 Minutes Into the Future runs at the Ontario College of Art and Design until January 20th. He's also giving a free lecture at the college tonight, as you mentioned, if you're in the Greater Toronto Area. If you're not, fear not. There is an attractively designed, fully functional, and futuristic website to visit. It's called KarimRashid.com. That's K-A-R-I-M Rashid, R-A-S-H-I-D.com. This is Q on CBC Radio 1, Sirius 137. I shift over to look to the left of me and see the boys in Elliot Brood. This is a bit of an interesting whirlwind, since we talked in the first 20 minutes of this show about how you're fascinated with the past, and then I moved back here. I want to hear, you guys are going to, you're set up to play another song for us. Elliot Brood, what's the song going to be?
It's called Gentle Temper, is the name of the song.
All right, Elliot Brood, live in Studio Q, Gentle Temper.
wakes me from sleeping, dreams of things I'll never be. Soon's cars pulling me back. Should I stand up and scream out loud? For I know I should be living our lives all the while, but it's been too long.
Studio Q, that's Elliot Brood and the song Gentle Temper. Very nice. What can you tell me about that song, Mark?
It was written above, well, where I used to live on Bloor Street, and there's a Kinko's across the street, and a lot of people, I don't know, it was like a moth, for moths, it was like a light for moths, and at the end of the night, everybody would actually go and seem to fight or argue right there in front of my window, and that's kind of the, you know, the inspiration for that song anyways, yeah.
Elliot Brood, the most recent album is called Ambassador, which actually came out a couple of years ago. I know you're and the boys are working on something new. That's right. And when can we expect that? By the way, for those of us who are getting tired of playing this CD over and over again,
excuse me. It's supposed to be we're going to be done. It'll be out in the spring of 08.
Nice. Okay. In the meantime, if you're in Waterloo, Ontario, November 15th, Toronto, November 16th, Peterborough, November 17th are some tour dates. And then a four-date tour of the Maritimes, Halifax, Charlottetown, Moncton, and St. John's, New Brunswick coming up, I guess, in late November. Is that right?
Yeah, just like the following week, actually. Yeah.
Okay.
You've downloaded Q, the podcast with Gian Gameshi. Highlights from CBC Radio 1's daily cultural magazine, and I am not Gian Gameshi.
You know we love it when you give us feedback on the conversations that you hear on Q. Here's one that got a lot of attention when we first aired it back in September. This is my conversation with British filmmaker Peter Greenaway about his latest project. Now, audiences are sometimes confounded by Greenaway's unconventional plots, but the look of his films is always dazzling. He's a painter with light, and the movie screen becomes his canvas in masterworks like The Cook, The Thief, His Wife and Her Lover, Drowning by Number, and his latest film, Night Watching. And now, a painter is his subject. Greenaway's latest film is a biopic about the 17th century Dutch master Rembrandt. With every brushstroke, it exudes Greenaway's signature style, long shots that hang like murals, and a story that comes together more like a collage than paint by numbers. Actor Martin Freeman plays Rembrandt, and you might remember him as the star of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, or as Tim in the BBC hit The Office, the British version. Night Watching screened at this year's Toronto and Atlantic film festivals, and I caught up with Peter Greenaway when he was in Halifax. Here's our conversation. Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Rembrandt. Where did your fascination with Rembrandt begin?
Well, at a very, very early age, I suppose about 12 or 13, I had the ridiculous idea that one day I wanted to be a painter. So I suppose in the most untutored, naive way, I began to associate myself, I think, by certainly looking and painting. And I became fascinated by Dutch landscape initially, I suppose. Mm. Eventually, I suppose in my late teens, I ended up in art school. So all my fantasies became a little more trained and organized. But I think in the 21st century, there's something about Rembrandt which makes him very, very modern. First of all, he doesn't paint like Jackson Pollock, so we can understand what he does. He's highly, highly figurative.
Oh, I see.
And I think also maybe he pushes all sorts of other buttons, too. He's a Republican and he's Democratic. Obviously, very important words for us, not only Mr. Bush nowadays. I think also he's a great humanitarian. He paints the people outside his front door. He's not Roman Catholic. He's not heroic. I think he has a good opinion of women. He's anti-misogynist, almost pro-feminist. He never paints an ugly painting of a woman, though of course he could paint an ugly woman. I think also maybe if we want to use some pompous contemporary words, he's post-Freudian. He's interested in the inner man. And I think you could also call him postmodernist.
Okay,
he takes an outward stand and is non-judgmental. Is that a long enough list for you?
I'm overflowing with things that I need to pick up on here, that, with ideas based on what you've just said. First of all, let me go take three steps back to the beginning of how you started, which your fascination with Rembrandt. You said you had the ridiculous idea to be a painter. Is that a ridiculous idea?
Well, yeah, retrospectively not, but if you come from a bourgeois family, you know, who thinks painting should be done on a Sunday afternoon after television, then that is rather a strange proposition to put to be a lifetime occupation. And I think generally, don't we think of painters as being a rather private, elitist sort of situation on
the
very,
I suppose,
very margins?
So, but we also maybe think of it, I've always thought it's quite romantic, you know, they have a romantic idea of painters, the real artists, you know. We'll stop at nothing to stand in front of a canvas and create their work.
Well, that's maybe relevant, I suppose, to the way we treated Rembrandt, because we didn't want to play those games, and we don't treat him as an amazing genius. He's basically the guy next door.
Why did you center your film around Rembrandt's most famous painting, The Night Watch?
Well, it's a mystery painting. It's been on view for about 400 years. And it's a painting that's been commented on by so many people because it's always been on view. And the general opinion now is it's full of mysteries. I think somebody counted 51 mysteries inside the painting. Mm. And there's also this big mystery about Rembrandt himself, who starts off very fashionable, very wealthy, and ends up as a pauper. And nobody's really been able to explain why. So Night Watching, our film, gives you a scenario of how to explain and put together all those 51 mysteries and find an explanation for them all, and also to explain why this situation of riches to rags story happened.
Now, for listeners who aren't familiar at the top of their minds with the painting, give us a brief sense of what the Night Watch looks like.
Well, it's painted in 1642, and it's about a bunch of 34 people, most of them dressed as soldiers, who are all assembling for musket practice.
What?
And Rembrandt paints these guys. They're all rich burghers dressing up as soldiers, pretending in some curious way to be heartfelt patriots.
What did Rembrandt want to expose by the people posing for him in The Night Watch?
Well, there is every evidence to suppose that Rembrandt was a bit of a satirist. He was always poking fun at tradition. He was an out-of-town lad. I suppose he come to the big city and made it good. Perhaps he had a chip on his shoulder. He left school at about 16. Certainly couldn't be regarded as an intellectual. Maybe there was a certain amount of envy and jealousy for these rich guys, established money around him. But the painting, for me, is his opportunity to be satirical again about Dutch society, about these shortcomings. Yeah.
And these rich, powerful men that he's painting.
That's right.
So to answer the mystery, was this what led to Rembrandt's fall from grace?
I believe so, and I think cogently we put it together all in this entertaining film for you to agree with me too.
Most cogently. It's interesting watching this film about Rembrandt, because what strikes me is he's a bundle of contradictions in a sense. He seems very to have very strong creative convictions. He knows what he wants. He's a very powerful presence. He's loud. He orders people around. At the same time, he's an emotional softy and a bit of a mess, and he seems open to manipulation and I wonder if this is some commentary about the idiosyncratic nature of artists that you see, or if this was unique to Rembrandt.
Well, haven't you just described you and me? Isn't that, you know, the vulnerability in us all and all the defense mechanisms and all the clevernesses and the vanities that we put together in order to protect our vulnerability? Everybody in this film is very, very vulnerable. Mm. And I think, I really do believe that's part of the human condition and is a fit subject matter, of course, to posit it in the most popular medium, which is cinema.
Okay, speaking of the guy next door, Martin Friedman, best known as Tim from the BBC TV series The Office, the original Office, he stars as Rembrandt. What did he reveal to you about Rembrandt through his performance?
Well, first of all, there have been several films about Rembrandt made often a long time ago, but they often posit Rembrandt as a very old man. So first of all, if we're going to be historically correct, Rembrandt was 36, I think, in 1642 when The Night Watch was played. Martin Friedman happens to be exactly the right age. That's a sort of coincidental happening. But I wanted somebody who had no sort of intellectual English theatre airs and graces, so wasn't part of the theatrical English tradition, was far away from somebody like Rupert Everett, for example. And obviously, having seen him in The Office, I knew he had these characteristics. He has a great sense of comic timing and a great sort of likability. I mean, okay, maybe he's a rough diamond and, you know, would you necessarily want to go down the pub with him? And again, related, I suppose, to what we've been talking about, I didn't want him in any way to feel extra special with any extra special airs and graces.
You've just come out with this new film, but at the same time, you've been lecturing on the death of cinema. Why in your mind is cinema dead or dying?
I'll give you a date, the 31st of September 1983, when the Zappa, or the remote control, was introduced into the living rooms of the world. Cinema now, with the laptop generation, the generation of X, I think that's even a Canadian phrase, isn't it?
Yeah, what?
Is really to do with an interactive multimedia world, and cinema can't be that. Cinema cannot create multiple endings, cannot be democratic. You can't interface with it in any satisfactory way. So I think if we're still going to excite imaginations with the potentiality of this grand audio-visual experience, we're going to have to find new ways of doing it. So what I would argue is the Casablanca syndrome, that cut-and-dried narrative bedtime story for adults phenomenon, is really finished. It doesn't really have a place anymore. That's not to say the screen is not going to disappear. I have a mobile phone in my pocket, and I suspect you have too, and it has a screen. Mm-hmm. And those screens now are going to be part and parcel of the communication experience, I think, of a visual world.
But when you say cinema is dead, you mean half a century from now? You don't mean now?
No, I would give you the date. I think, you know, the digital revolution had an effect on our visual medium in the year 1983. That's generally understood. I think the last real radical expositioners, if you wish, of cinema would have been the Germans in the 1970s. People like Fassbinder and Herzog. And that's the last time people were actually making radical experiments in celluloid narrative cinema. Hmm. We're now all lateral thinkers, and certainly we're all in encyclopedists. You know, we are browsers, we are laptop users, so we have to refashion this medium to be relevant to contemporary imaginations. And your boring old, you know, bedtime story for adult orthodox cinema is not going to satisfy that anymore.
Right, but boring old orthodox cinema does seem to be satisfying people rushing to the box office still.
Well, that's not true, is it? That really is not true.
Is it not? We've just come out of a big international film festival.
Big international film festival? There were about, 500 films there. Only about 50 of them, if you're lucky, are ever going to get distribution. Hmm. People aren't going to the cinema anymore. They haven't really been going to the cinema since the 1950s and the 60s.
So then what of this? Hollywood's had its biggest summer ever, you know, in terms of the take. What does that mean then?
Yeah, but most people would see these feature films on some sort of televisual phenomenon. Most people see Star Wars now on a DVD. They don't go rushing to the cinema. Hollywood offers you the figures that something like 75% of people watch all their feature films on television. Another 20% of people would buy the DVDs or the CD-ROMs or whatever the situation is. And only 5% of people who watch feature films actually watch them in cinemas. And those are figures actually coming out of Hollywood. So where is this boom?
Hmm. But you have to admit this, that we have heard this over and over again, right? With the introduction of the video cassette, etc., nobody will be going and seeing films anymore, and people still seem to end up. I mean, theaters are still being built. People are still going to the cinema. But I guess more specifically, you've just made a film. Why? I mean, you make a compelling argument, but why would you then go and make a film that some of us enjoy?
Well, I'm singularly lucky. I'm about to make a film on Second Life. I'm a VJ now. There's a whole range of different sorts of activities. So if you want to represent my career just by having a look at night watching, I think it's only a very, very small part of the output that I'm involved in. And I think if I'm going to make a film about Rembrandt and I'm going to appreciate what he did in visual terms, then I will choose the medium to make sure that that works. But over and above this, I do think that cinema language is extraordinary. But I would offer you the paradox that cinema is wasted on cinema. Because what we spend all our energy and money on is really stupid, dumbed-down stories we've all heard before. I'm sure when you go to the cinema, within 5 minutes, you know what's going to happen. You know how the character's going to fall out. You know how the thing is going to develop. We've used up all the tropes and the paradigms.
But sometimes I'm tremendously entertained or provoked in the process.
Well, maybe, again, you're a strange old nostalgia who still likes the illusion to wipe over you where, as Brecht once said, that most people go into the cinema and leave their brain with a hat check girl. Are you one of those?
I can't remember the hat check girl being at any of the cinemas that I've been to, but I might leave something with. Cinema is wasted on the cinema. What was the last film that you saw that you were excited by?
I think we'd have to go back about 15 years. What about David Lynch's Blue Velvet, I think? And that's some time ago now. I really have basically given up going to the cinema. I just find it so moribund and irrelevant to my interests. I sometimes feel that they make films, I make films, but they're giraffes and I'm hippopotami. And a hippopotami doesn't do very well in a giraffe race.
But Peter, even beyond the linear nature or the lack of new ideas, aren't there stories that... I'm thinking of Mike Lee films, where you the
oh,
stories are told.
Please don't talk to me about Mike Lee. I think he's the apotheosis of bad cinema. Why would you want to mimic reality? I can go next door and see reality. Why should I pay money to go to the cinema to do that? Cinema is a dream machine where we could go to places where we can never go. It's extraordinary. It's all part of that strange, curious, politically based English cinema, which I think is extremely boring. So please find me a better example.
Well, I'm a big fan of Mike Lee and Ken Loach and all of them. I like those stories coming to light because, I'll tell you why. Because they might be mirroring reality, but we don't often tell those stories to each other. We often live in a fantasy world and we don't recognize what's happening down the street or in the UK or wherever. And I like seeing those stories on the screen, as I like seeing Marjane Satrapi's Persepolis, an animated version of her book, which you said is also you're tired of. But I thought it was an incredibly exciting film that tells an important story of what happened in revolutionary Iran. You have nothing to say about that.
Well, yeah, a lot to say. But, I mean, you stated your case, I stated my case, and now we're checkmate.
You mentioned Second Life. And I hear you're working on a feature about Second Life?
No, inside Second Life.
Inside Second Life.
Inside that cyberspace.
Tell me why you're so interested. This is the 3D virtual world that's created by people all over the world and lives on the internet. Why are you so interested in Second Life?
Well, I do. I sincerely believe, every medium needs to be reinvented. Otherwise, it would still be in caves. Cave painting would still be listening to Mozart. Our cinema, it's going to necessarily become more interactive. And the potentiality of the notions of what we can do in cinema, for me, are writ 1,000 times more powerful in an environment like a cyberspace. And also, the exciting thing is that everybody can be involved. Hollywood is a form of elitism, only allowed for remarkably few numbers of people to practice in. And in our great new democratic post-digital revolution, there's a way which we can all participate. So, I don't know, let me take you an example. I'm sitting here in Halifax, the town that's associated with the sinking of the Titanic. We can all be on that ship as it goes down, if you so wish to be. And then again, we can all be on that ship when it comes up again. So the potentiality of time and space in a cyber world like Second Life is so extraordinary. I'm sure that's where the whole of cinema is heading.
I guess to bring it full circle and back to Rembrandt, will you take ideas and stories, like the story of Rembrandt, the ideas behind Rembrandt that you wanted to make a film about, and then take that into different mediums? Are you going to bring Rembrandt to Second Life?
Well, actually doing four things. I mean, there's a lot to say about him. So I'm now making a documentary for German television about him, and I've written a play. He's a guy who painted himself many, many, many times, a new play called Rembrandt's Mirror. So with an installation, a film, a documentary, and a play, I think I've had enough now, and I need to move on.
It's great speaking to you. Thank you so much for this.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's British director Peter Greenaway from our Halifax studio. His film Night Watching looks at the life of Rembrandt. It screened this year at both the Toronto and Atlantic film festivals, and we'll keep an eye out for its Canadian release date and let you know.
This is Q, the podcast. We're on CBC Radio 1 twice each weekday after local and regional noon programs, and again at 10 p.m., 10:30 in Newfoundland.
I'm back with our Friday Live guest, Elliot Brood, here live in Studio Q. Next album due out in early 2008, and we have been hearing their death country, their organic, banjo-driven, suitcase-pounding songs throughout the show. Mark Sasso, Steve Pick, and Casey Lefore, they are Elliot Brood. What are you going to play for us now, Mark?
We're going to play a song called T-Bill. It's
well, the loudest on the next record?
Yeah, possibly.
The loudest thing on the next record?
No. Oh. Loudest thing you'll hear today.
The loudest thing we'll hear today.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
It's called T-Bill?
T-Bill.
This is Elliot Brood, live in Studio Q. Playing the new song T-Bill. That's Elliot Brood live in Studio Q, bringing their outlaw country sounds. You guys even do you actually consider yourself part of the country tradition?
Yes.
You do?
No, I don't.
No, you're not sure?
No, not at all.
We had Ian Tyson on the show yesterday. I was feeling like this is, you know, sort of different kinds of eclectic country week here on...
We're modern country, like...
are we?
Sort of Garth Brooks, new
country.
Oh,
yeah, that's what it is. No, but a new style. That's a different kind.
Steve Pickin, Mark Sasso, Casey Lefore, Elliot Brood is the name of the band. They're in Waterloo next Thursday, Toronto next Friday, heading out to the East Coast for a number of dates at the end of the month. They're playing along with the Acorn, the Sun Park, Parlor Players, and Plants and Animals on the Wood Wires and Whiskey Tour. That's Exclaim Magazine's Wood Wires and Whiskey Tour. We're all just still reeling from that Karam Rashid conversation, right? Obsessed with all the things he was saying. Mark, did you have say you wanted to comment on his ideas about ownership?
Well, yeah, I don't know. It just kind of, I mean, he's obviously well thought out, and he knows what he kind of wants to say. But I just kind of found like the ownership thing, never owning or never wanting to own anything. It's just like, well, why are we creating these cameras? We're trying to, you know, we're shooting all these memories and things, and we want to own them, right? You kind of like, I don't know, you need those things in order to own your memories or in order to own all these things. And I think a lot of people, I don't know, I would kind of tend to disagree. I kind of need those things, those tangible elements in my life not to make me feel better, but to kind of remind me of different things or to fill my life with. I don't.
I'm just confused. I still love antiques.
I'm going to throw my cassette collection, though. I think after today.
No, I got
to
take.
Hang on to the cassette collection. I'm sure it sounds great.
Yeah. Oh yeah. You know it.
All right, Elliot Brood, it's a pleasure having you here. You do stick around, but thanks again for being here. The record is called Ambassador. If you don't have it, you should check it out. Elliot Brood, by the way, spelled Elliot with two L's and two T's, and Brood is B-R-O-O-D. Elliot Brood, the album Ambassador. Look for their new record coming out in the new year. You've been listening to Q, the podcast. Hey, you can hear Q, the program, every weekday afternoon and evening on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite 137. I'm Gian Gomeshi. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.